Thank you for lunch as well. We're going to call to order the Carl Committee, which is Compliance, Audit, Risk Management, and Legal Affairs. Would you please call the roll?
Trustee Robert Boyd. Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Wheeler Coleman. Trustee Robert Marshall.
Here.
Trustee Tim Struthers.
Here.
Board Chair Mark Strauss.
Here.
Committee Chair Sherilyn Muir.
Here. Thank you. Mr. Blakemore, do we have a quorum and have appropriate notices under the Illinois Open Meetings Act been given?
Madam Chair, we have a quorum, and this meeting has been called in compliance with the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the proposed agenda?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. We have a motion to approve the minutes of November 12, 2015.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. This is the point in our agenda where the chair may recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our recording secretary, Mr. Blakemore. Has the committee received any requests to address this meeting?
Madam Chair, we have not received any requests to address this committee meeting.
Thank you. I would like to recognize the leaders of the university constituency group. Dr. Greg Long, always nice to have you in each of these meetings.
Oh, and it couldn't be a more fun day. Thank you. I enjoy the opportunity, actually. Thank you very much. Would say, with regard to this committee, when we had our last meeting November the 12th, I talked a little bit about the risk management initiative and the importance with that as we move forward of looking at accessibility from a disability standpoint, both physical accessibility as well as technology accessibility. That's an area where we don't, from a technology standpoint, still need to do some work on that. The other area that is we're looking at enterprise risk management has to do with getting a better handle and process on our grievance and mediation concerns, because that there's still a bit of confusion and lack of direction sometimes with those issues, so would encourage those as continued areas of interest. As another just update, we did have Police Chief Phillips come to Faculty Senate meeting and answered a lot of concerns from faculty with regard to health and safety issues on campus, and found that was a very, very valuable opportunity to talk with him. And then the last thing as it relates to this committee is certainly support the discussion concerning freedom of expression, particularly given this time in our history with the budget and concerns. As a tenured faculty member, freedom of expression is you know, essentially guaranteed to me. I appreciate that privilege, but I think we also need to be sure that we provide that same opportunity for staff as well as untenured faculty and students as well. So discussion on this, I think, is very valuable.
Thank you. I particularly appreciate your sensitivity to the needs of the disabled as we move forward. So your expertise is to be highlighted in that area.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
30 or 11 o'clock, you're right on time.
Yeah. Trustee Boy is here. Would you please make note in the record? Yes. Okay.
Present.
Thank you very much. And Steve Bilta, would you like to make any comments about regarding this committee?
Yes, thank you. In kind of following along what Greg was talking about, I was quite pleased to see the topic of freedom of expression being addressed at today's agenda. I've been a student and an employee here at Northern for many years, and I have never seen a time where there is so much uncertainty and concern being expressed by students, faculty, and staff, nor have I seen so many opportunities for students, faculty, and staff to really impact the direction of this institution or to participate in the critical decisions being made at the state level. The key truly to being able to address these uncertainties and to participate in this discussion is really encouraging that open and free discussion and debate of ideas. And I support and I applaud the work that's being done here on campus the real move towards transparency that, that President Baker has really promoted. And I think it's going a long way towards trying to help the community.
I would encourage you as leaders, though, to also help enhance the sensitivity to the appropriateness of intellectual discourse, but with responsibility and with orientation to the best interest of this university as a hallmark of the state of Illinois. Holly Nicholson, hello.
Yes, thank
how are you?
You? Good afternoon.
You're president of the Operating Staff Council.
Yes, that's correct.
Do you have any comments?
I do, thank you. Related to the discussion of risk management today, I'd like to encourage the dedication of resources to ensure that HR policies and procedures, especially the operating staff and SBS handbook, are updated and posted online as soon as possible. Operating without access to the most updated policies and procedures puts the university at risk. Thank you.
Thank you. The agenda today continues our effort to keep the committee updated on issues within its jurisdiction while simultaneously providing an opportunity to have substantive discussion of issues which may require committee action. There are two items which fall within the category of necessary committee updates, and I say that with great positive, in a very positive manner. I'm very interested to continue to hear on an ongoing basis the status of the Enterprise Risk Management Initiative. And as you recall, we structured it in the way as if an outside body were coming to present to this board. And Dr. Phillips has done an excellent job thus far in keeping this board apprised of progress. The second area will be Executive Order 1509, which is the governor's executive order related to acceptance of gifts. So we have two major items to address today, but we're going to begin with Dr. Phillips with an update on the progress related to the Enterprise Risk Management Initiative.
Good afternoon. Once again, it's a pleasure for me to come up and bring the board up to speed with all the good work that's been going by our Enterprise Risk Management committees to further this effort along. And what I'll do is, when I put together, I know this is an update, but when I put together a presentation, I like for it to stand on its own so that if you go back and refer to it, all the pieces are there. So even though this is an update, I'll go through some of the charts fairly quickly because there are things that you've seen before. Next chart. Enterprise risk management, of course, is a continuous process and a tool that combines compliance and control with strategic decision making. Next chart, please. Basically, you identify risks, you take steps to assure the risks are being controlled, you provide leadership and the board the means to track significant risks and develop over time a culture, and in our case, we're working on developing a program for risk management that will carry on well into the future. Next chart, please. Issues prompting discussion of risks, I think most of these we're quite familiar with. Clearly, these are issues we deal with daily here at NIU. Next chart. And so as a part of this effort, we established basically two teams. The first is the core team that's led by Dave Stone, who the chair referenced earlier today in a different committee, who's been doing a wonderful job leading this effort. We brought in expertise from our faculty. And we have on the core team Scott Mubery, who's the director of our health, our Environment, Health, and Science Department, Emily Hochstetter, who is our director of risk management, and they are the core team that are pulling together the effort and doing the lion's share of the work. Next chart, please. Another click. There we go. Beyond that, we have a full committee that we are working with, and we will take the work of the core committee too, and I'll talk about that here in a second. Next chart. Terms of reference. When I talk about terms of reference, when I do a project like this, the first thing I do is list all the questions that we have to answer. And so as you go through the effort, ideally, once you've answered all the questions, you would hope that you would be done with the project. And so these are some of the questions that we started out trying to address. You know, what is it we do? How important are they? What is the nature of risks in those areas? How severe of a risk event could take place? How effectively have we controlled for those risks? What are our strategies? And what initiatives do we need to put into place to ensure that these risks have been properly identified, assessed, mitigated, controlled, and managed going forward? Next chart, please. These are the risk consideration. You'll see we are looking risk areas. Obviously, these are pretty much functional types of areas, academic affairs, ancillary services, enrollment. We have enrollment risk. Usually when you think of risk, you think insurance. We're looking in a much broader context. Governance, human capital, research, IT, student affairs, and other things. You have types of risk: financial, health, safety, operational, reputational, strategic, and compliance. And then you have to look at it in terms of internal risks, external risks, and emerging issues or challenges. Next chart. It is as we said before, it is a continuous management process. And here we have identified basically seven phases. You set your strategy, you identify the risk, assess the risk, treat the risk, control for the risk, and then communicate and monitor how well you're doing in either mitigating or eliminating the risks. Next chart. So far in the process, we have done phase one, and we are into phase two and three. The next step after we finish phase three will be to bring together the full enterprise risk management team to take a look at the work done by the core committee, design action plans, communicate, and then design dashboards and set timelines to monitor the progress. Next chart. In phase two, yes.
Would you go back to that process activities and kind of give us timelines related to each of these phases?
Well, I'm actually getting to that.
Okay, thank you.
You're two charts ahead of me.
Okay.
The steps in the process, two and three, this is currently the activity that is going on. We are identifying strategic objectives, the level of the goals and objectives are, unit-level activities, risk associated with those activities, the severity and the frequency. Next chart, please. So far, we have met with facilities management, the Office of the General Counsel, International Affairs, and Public Safety. Our next meetings over the next couple of weeks are athletics and research, and then in May we plan to meet with human resources, IT, academic affairs, and outreach. Next chart, please. What you see here is actually the results from the first four meetings. This is a heat map that shows the severity of these risks and the likelihood that they will occur or the frequency. If you go down to the bottom left, those are low occurrences, low severity. We don't have anything in those boxes because those are not the things that we're worried about. If you look up into the red area where you have increased severity and increased frequency, we have a number of items that we've identified that we will be looking at in more detail. However, as we go through the process, we're not waiting to get till we finish this effort. For some of the things, we're also taking a look at, even though there may be a risk, has it been mitigated? In many cases, there have been steps taken to address these risks. However, I will pull one off the list, and that's the steam plant, as most of you know. Our newest boiler, I think, was put in place in 1962. We have concerns about the continued operations of our heating plant. We like to have heat in the winter and cool air in the summer. Many of our boilers are struggling, I will say. And so actually at the FFOC, we're bringing an item to the board that will enable us to bring in an outside engineering firm to take a look at a comprehensive plan for how best to address that going forward. So some of these things we're not waiting on, these are the areas that we've identified so far in terms of risk and frequency that we will address in more detail.
Designed to show all of the issues that surfaced from these four areas, or is this just illustrative at this point?
This is illustrative. This will grow as we talk with more folks and meet with, but these are the main key issues that have been identified in the meetings that we've held so far.
The reason I ask is that as I've sort of given thought to what would be on my list, which in many cases doesn't get to the level of specificity that you have in your heat map, there are some things that I would have expected to arise from these areas that don't appear on the chart. And so I'm wondering whether at some point it would be appropriate to circle back and to have some way to check with us to see whether we have any input on this. I mean, we're not devoting the same right level of attention to it that you are. I don't want to substitute my judgment for yours in this regard. But there may be some things that I've thought about that, for whatever reason, don't surface.
Okay, absolutely. The other point I wanted to make is this is not a one-time effort. The intent is to develop a program where on a regular basis we go back, we revisit, we review, we update, so that this is a continual process going forward. It's not just something that we do once and then move on to other things, but I appreciate that counsel, and we will do that. Next chart. The other side of the coin, you have risk opportunities. So also in the discussions, as they identify the risks, and we haven't really gotten into this to any great degree at this point, as we're still going through and identifying the risk, but I just want to show this as kind of an example along with the heat map. Now we have likelihood and impact of how to address some of these issues or opportunities that or ideas that people have for good ways to deal with these issues or address these risk factors. And we will put more detail on this as we go forward. Next chart. So next steps. Phase four is to treat the risks. The full ERM team, Enterprise Risk Management team, will be meeting in April. They're going to review and discuss the information gathered so far, identify risks that cut across a number of areas, look more holistically at the risk map, take a look at and to determine which risks may be more critical than others, and review potential opportunities for how to address those risks. And as I just said before, in these meetings, we've also not been talking just about risk, but also opportunities or way to mitigate some of these risks that we will come back to later. Next chart, please. Phase five is to control and mitigate the risks. And in May, the core team will go back then and take a look at the full team's recommendations. They will then modify heat maps to account for the relative presence or absence of controls. Where strong controls exist, they will move down in our risk rankings. So now they will start looking at not just the risk, but the risk in the context of what actions have been taken to date or what action can be taken short term to mitigate the risks. And those risks that are severe or lack mitigation will certainly rise to the top. For those areas of highest risk where the gap is large, the expectation is that proposals for enhancing mitigation will be formulated by the affected units and placed in the annual and five-year budget process. So part of this is also not to just come up with a plan or a program, but I have learned that which gets funded gets done. And so once we have identified the areas where we have some weaknesses, to put funding in the budget to address these issues on a long-term basis. Next chart. Towards the end of May, we're looking forward to getting back with the full Enterprise Risk Management team. They will review and discuss the results. of the mitigation reviews. They will work to develop dashboards or metrics that we can use to help us going forward identify how well we're doing, and then also to discuss the ongoing enterprise risk management infrastructure, how we should structure the organization to continue this effort going forward. Next chart. Bottom line is the enterprise risk management initiative is on track and continues to move forward. We've had excellent participation and support throughout the campus. The meetings have been very good. These are people who are very interested and working very hard collectively to try to identify our risk challenges and figure out ways to address them. We have already identified risks that need to be addressed more quickly than others. In some cases, we're not waiting to address those. We believe we're on schedule, and our ultimate goal is to have a comprehensive enterprise risk management program in place as we go into fiscal year 17. Next chart. Questions?
Okay. You open it up for questions. I do have a comment, and it's a comment in regards to the way in which you've presented the information. These heat charts, which I know are de rigueur in today's methodology of provision of data, still to me doesn't give me the information I'm looking for. I find this very weak. Mm-hmm. And I also I don't like the incorporation on the one sheet of facilities, legal, international programs, so that we're drilling down to a level of need more snowplows. And I look at this and say, are we missing the big picture? So I would encourage you to not wait till the next mm-hmm. board meeting
sure.
to provide an update to the board. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see it broken down into what are the key areas of mm-hmm. consideration in these, especially the difference between international programming and facilities
sure.
are very different. And using a red, yellow, and green zone, I think, is fine. What's the level of risk, and the sense of immediacy would dictate whether it's red or green, mm-hmm. with a legend that would really describe what do we mean by this, how do we define it. Mm-hmm. So I think as it relates to the presentation, I think we could do a lot better in the core matter of what we're trying to discuss. And I would think that that would help the board, especially as we're looking at this. And in keeping with Trustee Strauss's comments, the board wants to be interactive with you in the process, not at the end. So a clearer understanding of what are the key factors that you've identified through your committees, mm-hmm. breaking it down, not using just one lump sum of areas, I think would really be helpful. So
okay.
if you would do that, I'd
sure.
appreciate it.
Okay. I'd be happy to.
All right. Any other, John?
I'm just trying to get a sense of, for the heat map, has there been an assessment of these risks yet, or are they placed on here based on the assumption that there'll be an assessment and they'll be placed in these positions?
We're in the process of identifying the risks, and in some, without any consideration necessarily for what's been done already or how much they've been mitigated. As we go forward, there will be more detail on each one of these. They may move down once we take a look at each risk and how it's been addressed. In some cases, we have risks that are pretty much fully addressed. In other cases, you have risks that have not yet been addressed, such as the steam plant. And so we will have much more detail. But for right now, we're in the collection process and the identification process. Once we get beyond that, then we will look more specifically at all these risks, and they may move on the chart depending on how they've been addressed to this point.
Are you okay? Mm-hmm. Again, I want to just make a comment about this. I don't want us to not see the forest for the trees on this. And I would like to see you come back, for example, when you're talking about facilities. Mm-hmm. You certainly should be able to aggregate information about building maintenance and safety on roads, which deals with snow plows, are such a minor thing. It's the means to an end. I think there can be better work done on this in terms of how it's being shown to the board, even in its work stage. I'm not seeing these core elements. And even if you work on the basis of a hypothesis, you don't have to prove it first.
Sure.
We believe that we have since we've deferred maintenance for 117 years, we may be having some roof problems. That's a hypothesis. Then prove it. Is that a red zone, a green zone, a yellow zone? I think we could do a better job in how we present the material.
Okay. We can do that.
Thank you. Wheeler, you had a comment? Or Tim first?
The idea of like a data breach, I didn't see that on there. I see it's not in the heading. And I would add to Sherilyn's comments, I think the concept of what we're doing is great. Obviously, it's like so many things we should have done a decade ago, right? But the fact that we're doing it is good. My concern was with the heat map as well, that we were on really little things, and then the heading seemed random. And then such things that to me that would be one of the highest risk would be a data breach. I didn't see any such.
We have not yet met with IT.
Okay.
Once we meet with them, I suspect there will be a number of items that are added to the list, of which that would certainly be one. Okay. This is follow just on. The four. This just comes from the four folks that we've met with so far.
So IT is scheduled for the March time frame, and the four that have been completed, and I'm on page 12, it's the facility, legal, international, and public safety. So now you have a blend of the completed items, and that's why it looks like,
an odd
combination. But those are the four meetings that were conducted. You know, and out of due respect, I want to say, I like the heat map scenario. I use heat map scenarios because I think they provide a good visual of what we're up against, and if you count the dots, we got 25 high risk items that have been called out of these four meetings that have been performed. Now, granted, if we need more information, what is that, right? And so the double click or the click down from that, it's what's missing from the deck.
Correct.
And I'm assuming that information is available.
We do have that, and we can certainly add that and put a little more depth to the presentation, which is, I believe, what you're looking for.
Yeah. And probably from to prevent this look of this possible hodgepodge of stuff, we probably should have a heat map for every meeting, right? Have a separate heat map so people can see it.
We can certainly, I'm guessing we've already done that. We just didn't
probably
include them all in this.
But your blend here is kind of an odd
Correct.
Setup, right? But that's, but I think I understand where you're headed here. And I have yellow on my sheet. Is that green? Is that supposed to be green?
Well, any risk would not be green, I would say. Those are just the ones where they're low risk, low frequency.
And so what's the financial exposure? What is that?
The financial exposure is considerable. Look here.
There's a heading called financial exposure.
That would be the safety and security of our investments.
Investments.
That's right.
Even the stock market, even though it's tumbling a little.
We invest our money. It's all in very secure places. But
All right. I got it. Thanks.
I would like to say though that. Our comments should be taken for what they are, and I think that we're very candid because of the great respect we have for you, Dr. Phillips, and that we understand that you are appreciating our comments. It's trying to get the information in a way that will help us make decisions, and we have to be careful that we don't go from the most micro to the most macro
Correct.
Within the same sentence, and that's what we're asking for.
Right. At the current stage, we're trying to collect all the risk factors to get an idea of what they all are. the next steps, we will drill down into them and prioritize them, and then you can take a look at, for each area, what the key risk factors are and how they need to be mitigated and what the cost for that would be and when we would go about addressing those. So
and
you
will
see
more detail.
And will
you provide us with a prioritization then?
Mm-hmm. Eventually, once we get through this, we absolutely will. Because if we're going to budget for this, we have to have priorities so that we know what the biggest risks are, the ones we want to address first. No, that's like backlog maintenance and repair exceeds our annual budget right now. So we have to establish priorities, and part of this process is to go through on a regular basis and do that. On an annual basis, and then the results of that would feed into the budget, and we would program for those things in the future.
Yeah, okay. You know, if you don't mind,
a
comment. I suspect you're going to have that same scenario when you start looking at IT.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of hidden risk to organizations that many times we don't even know exists. That's sitting in our data centers or how we contract something, right? So whether it's outdated equipment, outdated software, the life of applications, all of that is risk to the organization. And we've got to make sure that we understand that everything has a life cycle, and if we don't upgrade and perform a maintenance according to the scheduled life cycle, then we create risk to the institution. And so I suspect we're going to have a tremendous amount of that, similar to maintenance on the roofs and some of our buildings. We probably will have that in our data center.
Well, and actually, roofs are two of the things you'll be seeing here very shortly at the FFOC committee meeting, because those are a priority.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next point on our agenda is an update by Special Counsel and Ethics Officer Jim Gagliardo on the Governor's executive order regarding the gift ban, as well as an update on statements of economic interest and ethics training. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I know we're a little bit behind today, so I'll try to speed through this best I can. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Wheeler. The Governor's Rauner's Executive Order 1509 is now a year old, and I figured to give an update on what it affects, what it doesn't affect. One of the things it affects is statements of economic interest. Not every employee is affected by statements of economic interest. The other thing the executive order affects is the gift ban, which every employee is affected by. So let me start with statements of economic interest. This year, as with last year, there's going to be two different forms. First, you'll be getting all board members and many employees who basically have responsibility for contracting will be getting this form in the mail at their home address from the Secretary of State. It'll be mailed around March 14th, and the deadline to get it done is May 2nd, so you'll have a month and a half to do that. I'll be sending an email to all employees who are affected by this, setting forth these deadlines and how you comply with this. As I'll say in the email, I appreciate if you get me your completed statement so I can review it for completeness, because if it isn't complete, the Secretary of State's going to bounce it back. If it doesn't have a date, if it doesn't have a signature, if you leave one blank, it gets bounced back. I like to review them for completeness. So I appreciate if you get those to me, and I will mail them to the Secretary of State. The second form is a creature of Governor Rauner's Executive Order 1509. And the employees this applies to got this yellow form last year in the mail, not from the Secretary of State, but from the Executive Ethics Commission. And this just adds questions about economic circumstances. This year, you will not be getting this form in the mail. The Executive Ethics Commission is going to try to do this all online. So, see how that works. Supposedly, in late March, you'll be getting an email. Either from me or the Executive Ethics Commission, showing you how to log in. You'll be getting the form, completing the form, and submitting it online. I believe that's also due, yes, that is also due on May 2nd as well. Obviously, board members, any employees that these statements of economic interest apply to, feel free to give me a call. They're pretty straightforward, but depending on what assets you have or financial tools you have. There can be some difficulties as whether or not you have to report this on there or not. Feel free to give me a call. Feel free to email me. Ask me questions. That's what I'm here for, is to help fill these things out. Moving on to the gift ban of Executive Order 1509. This has caused not a lot of confusion, but it causes a lot of questions, and that's good. I get a ton of questions on this. The main thing that Governor Rauner's Executive Order 1509 did was it eliminated what used to be a $100 a year per vendor exception to the gift ban. In other words, an employee, NIU employee, could take up to $100 in gifts from a private vendor in a year, whether it be a gift certificate or equipment, whatever, Amazon Kindle, whatever, as long as it was below $100, you could accept that. That has been done away with by the executive order. Basically, it's zero now. If you're an employee, you cannot take a gift. Well, let me slow down, because there are still some exceptions I'm going to get to. There's no longer that $100 exception to taking a gift from a private vendor. However, and this is where a lot of the confusion comes in, it doesn't mean you can't necessarily take a gift. There are still exceptions. And let me go through four that I routinely come across, leads to some confusion, if not confusion, at least questions. Number one, there's nothing in the gift ban that prevents a private vendor giving a gift to the university as a body. Okay, the gift ban deals with giving gifts to individual employees. A vendor, I know car dealers have given gifts, cars to the athletics department, art, sometimes private vendors give art to the university. That is not affected, and that is not prohibited under the gift ban, as long as the gift is truly for the institution and not for an individual. So in other words, let me give you the car example. If a car dealer gives a car to the university, maybe only one employee uses that car, that's fine. If that employee uses that car for personal use, at the very least, they have to record their mileage, they have to pay for the gas, and certainly when the employee leaves that position or leaves the university, obviously the gift, in this case the car, will not go with the employee. It must stay with the university. Another exception is a gift from a government entity, whether it be the state of Illinois, the federal government, or a foreign government, quite frankly. And I actually see this quite a bit. We deal with other public universities overseas, in Europe, in Asia, and it's very common, sometimes as a cultural aspect of dealing with them, where officials of these public universities overseas would like to give gifts to our employees. As long as it's a government university, whether it be in Europe, whether it be in Asia, whether it be in the United States, an employee can accept the gift from a government entity, whether it be a university or any other government entity. That is not banned by the gift ban. The biggest exception I deal with is employees can accept the gift from a private vendor as long as there's an educational mission or purpose to the gift. And I get a lot of calls on this, but the usual circumstance is an employee is offered travel and lodging for attendance at a seminar or a conference. As long as that conference or that seminar actually helps the employee do their job, you can accept that gift. Now, there is a requirement that I have to, the ethics officer of an institution, does have to review the conference materials, the seminar materials, to make sure the seminar really does help the employee in his or her job. And I do that. A lot of people make these requests all the time. Can you look at these seminar materials? I do. And almost always approve, as long as there's a nexus between the seminar and what people are doing. The last exception really is not an exception, but I still get calls about it, still get inquiries about it, and that's really a quid pro quo from a vendor to an employee. We often have employees speaking at a conference or giving a presentation at a conference, and a vendor says, well, we're going to pay your travel, we're going to pay your lodging, we're going to pay your meals, and I get calls from employees saying, can I take that? And the answer is yes, it's not a gift. They want your expertise. They want you to do a presentation. They're covering your costs. I get calls and emails from faculty that review textbooks for publishers. Same thing. If you're reviewing a textbook for a publisher, if a faculty member is, or anybody this might apply to, and the publisher's paying, that would not be considered a gift, and it's not prohibited by the gift ban. Obviously, departmental policies still have to be followed, but it's not prohibited by the gift ban. Last thing I want to say is I just want to say a word about ethics training and end with some good news here. This does not have to do with Governor Rauner's executive order, but we administered ethics training this year to 7,632 employees, including student employees, temporary employees. All of them, all 7,632, completed the training before the deadline. We didn't have to send out any disciplinary warnings. We didn't have to have their supervisors take any disciplinary action against any of these employees. That's pretty amazing. You might be tempted to say, big deal, isn't that what's supposed to happen? That's true. But we sent our final report to the Executive Ethics Commission, and I spoke with the executive director of the commission. He says it is extremely unusual for an institution with thousands of employees not to have at least a few, 5, 10, even 15 employees that they haven't met the deadline and you have to start taking action against. So we made a lot of phone calls, sent out a lot of emails, talked to some supervisors that last couple of weeks before the deadline, but we got everyone last one trained prior to the deadline, and we'll, of course, aim to do the same thing next year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'm open to any questions.
Questions? I do have one question, just a point of clarification.
Sure.
And it may be semantics, but I want that clarification. You had talked about it's in the same phrase you used a gift to the university is permissible, and then you gave an example of the athletic department.
Yeah.
So I want clarification because to me the university means it would be in the discretion of the president. If it, or are you saying it can be departmental or to a college? Is there a difference in your mind in how you describe that?
No, there isn't. Neither one would violate the gift ban. As long as it's being given to an entity, the entity, the university, or the entity, and maybe Al Phillips knows better whether they're considered to be different or not, an entity like athletics or accounting and the actual university.
So then the question is, how far down do you go in terms of it not being a violation and in the discretion to accept? Is it a department? Is it a division? Is it a college? Is it the university?
I think it is the entity. As a matter of fact, we've had gifts given to, for instance, materials management. A vendor will come in for around the holidays and maybe provide candy, whatever, okay, to the entire
department.
So
as long as it's an entity, not an individual, that's the decision?
Yeah, the more widespread the gift is, the less likely it's going to be considered banned by the gift ban. But as long as it's spread throughout a department or a college or the entire university, like art that would be displayed maybe out in the commons or something, the less likely it's going to run afoul. Obviously, if somebody gives, the dean of some college a tie and says, well, this tie is for the department, the dean can't go around wearing that tie and nobody else wears the tie.
It's
kind of hard to share a tie.
Sign-up sheet.
Yeah, it
All
is,
right.
unless there's
Thank
an
you,
artistic.
Jim.
Okay.
All right, yes.
Oh,
excuse me, yeah.
Can I follow up on that? So let me give you an example.
Sure.
Let's say that a vendor throws a reception for an athletic purpose in support of or fundraising for the athletic department.
Mm-hmm.
And we're board members and we go to that and we consume food and we drink a glass of wine, etc. Have we violated the gift ban?
No, because that's one specific provision of the gift ban, even in the executive order I didn't talk about. You can, as long as you are in your duties, attend a business-related function and consume de minimis food and drinks provided by a vendor.
Okay.
As long
as you don't get drunk.
He said de minimis.
That's banned by the gift ban and many other
acts. In the interest of time, I think we will move on. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thanks.
All right. We have an action item, which this is an action item.
The action is the president advising you all.
All right, so it's not an action item. Okay. All right, the president will provide this committee a national perspective on issues facing college campuses related to freedom of speech, an overview of where NIU is and where we may want to go, related to our constitutional rights, responsibilities, privileges, and obligations. But this is not an action. This is just informational. All right. So, President Baker, will you address that, please?
Yes, thank you, and thank you for that clarification. We're not asking you to vote on this today, but we have in process a conversation that's been going on for a number of months regarding freedom of expression on campus. And as we all know, it is a hot and very important issue around the country, as we've seen with student demonstrations and protests at various universities around the country. Missouri, Yale, and others have seen these. As we began looking at this issue many months ago, we went back and looked at our policies, and we found that in the early 1970s, a policy was developed. So 45 years ago, we had a policy developed. And the focus then was on solicitation, about people being annoyed by solicitors on campus. And there was some parameters put around that in specific small areas on campus where you could solicit people. And the title of that policy made it sound more like it was around freedom of speech rather than solicitation. And there were two areas on the Martin Luther King Square and the Convocation Green Square where you could do this solicitation. But in fact, we have in our Northern Pact we do with our students an expectation for open dialogue, and we expect open dialogue. In fact, our view is that we need broad latitude to speak and write, listen, challenge, learn. That's what universities are all about. And as Greg suggested earlier, it's not just the faculty that have that right. That's everybody that has that right. We're a university. So we looked around at policies in the country. We found one at our neighboring school, University of Chicago, that has a very good free speech statement and well thought out. And we've adapted it and have a in-process draft that you have in front of you today and that we're continuing to work through. So the university really wants to respect and support freedom of expression as granted by the First Amendment and is common in universities. But we also want to be cognizant on limitations that can be there for the safety of the community. So the summary draft proposal, as I noted, is here for you. It has a clear commitment of freedom of expression and open discussion on campus. It also has a simultaneous commitment to assure campus safety and an environment and safe environment so we can continue our operations. We want to make sure that all of our walkways and open spaces are open for free speech and expression, not just the commons or some square. We want to encourage lively and rigorous debate on these issues rather than having a university trying to determine what speech is okay and what speech isn't. But as Chair Muir said earlier, we want to have civility and collegiality in all of this. And so we're taking proactive steps to do that. We're taking actions to promote inclusion and mutual respect across the entire university. Vernice Edgehill-Walden, our Chief Diversity Officer in BAC, is helping guide us through a series of diversity dialogues, including sessions on free speech, First Amendment, and lawful assembly, and another forum open discussion on various topics with NIU and the DeKalb community and presidential commissions. So these actions seem to be preferable than trying to restrict free speech is to try to promote civil discourse. So protection of free speech when there are not attempts to restrict it, even when that speech is not popular, we need to question all that. So the process for review and development of the freedom of expression policy has been ongoing, and it will go forward with input from the presidential commissions, various student body organizations, and the shared governance process. So we're working hard on this. We wanted you to know that this important topic is being addressed at the university right now, and that we're having good dialogue. We'll have more, and I appreciate Dr. Edgehill-Walden's work to put these dialogues together, and she's been including a planning group that has a broad array of representatives on it. So Harlan Teller and Jerry Blakemore have both been working on this with us. I'm sure they can go into any of the details as well. So just wanted to get that in front of you so you know we're working this issue.
Let me ask the trustees if you have any questions or comments, Mark.
Given that this hasn't received any attention for quite some time, I believe it's very appropriate that we look at it currently. And I applaud the broad spectrum of input that is being solicited. I'd encourage you to continue to make the input received as broad as possible before there's something on which we are asked to take action. Is there a timetable for when there may be a finished product?
Well, we want to have these dialogues this spring, so I think we'll get through those and then get the input from the various governance groups and probably try and come to some conclusion this summer.
Thank you.
And then have that ready for the processes in the fall as we kick off the fall semester.
Okay, Trustee Butler.
I wonder if we couldn't delineate more clearly in this policy the manner in which we, because there are no sort of subheadings, but I wonder if we could be more clear as to the policies that govern free expression in the classroom versus in the public space or the space of the campus. Because I'm mindful of the Wheaton situation. I'm in looking at the slides in this book, I noticed that there was some discussion of if a professor were to share their own personal views on religion, et cetera, in the context of a class lecture, that could be problematic at some level. I'm curious if we can sort of flush out some of that so that there's guidance and it's clear and we understand it. I guess that's all really I want to say. If there's some follow-up, I'm happy to.
Very good question. The policy itself is not going to get into what I would refer to as the more specifics regarding guidance for particular places on campus. However, the policy, broadly defined, would basically allow for freedom of expression any place, every place, except in circumstances where you are protecting public safety. That's one of the limitations. Specifically with the classroom, there would be a designation that does provide limitations with respect to, I would say, not just classrooms, but laboratories, for an example. Here, the public safety issue becomes critical. But we would not have that in the broader policy, but there would be, and the policy does call for, further defining sort of specific areas. So the president would designate areas where. And what we have here is the broadest designation of where that freedom of expression would take place. But you are absolutely right. Part of the issue is balancing one's rights, First Amendment, by both the U.S. Constitution and the Illinois State Constitution, which has a provision as well that we would obviously comply with the issues of the public having a right to be safe. And in the academic sort of community, collegial and civil, so as part of it as well. So.
Any other comments? I'd like to just add a comment to this, and I think it's in the nature of all the comments that have been made. I think that this, since we're a university, this also lends itself to a teaching experience, and I think that perhaps it could be incorporated appropriately within classroom settings on how to articulate and persuade, especially related to controversial issues, and how to present persuasive argument with an appropriate demeanor. I think if we could teach our students that would be a wonderful objective. And I think as you teach, then you also recognize that for yourself. So I think the learning experiences are both for the faculty and for the students, and perhaps we can become a model at NIU in how to deal with freedom of expression, but with, and I think we've all used the word, with appropriate civility and in a way that is more persuasive than simply, you know, yelling and screaming a position. So how to be persuasive in the appropriate utilization of this freedom. So I pose that as a challenge. Okay? Okay, very good. Thank you, Dr. Baker. Appreciate that. Are there any follow-up items that the committee wishes to address? Yes? Excuse me?
In general, is that the question?
Yeah, sure.
An observation on the committee, Compliance Audit Risk Management Legal Affairs. So I'm reminded of, we all receive what would appear to be somewhat random audits electronically. And within the audits themselves, there will be comments and findings that may be a dozen or so. So two observations. One is the comments themselves don't appear to be in a format or fashion of severity or direction of risk, but probably more concerning, the idea of the audits themselves just seem to come in from time to time, and I would have no idea of the overall status of the audit plan, the outstanding items themselves. Are they delinquent? The severity of the issues and so on. It just seems with an organization of this size and complexity, there would be a master template that would start with that. This is the audit schedule, and how we're doing with respect to that schedule and what the outstanding issues are, and the magnitude of the risk.
I'll make a comment then turn it over to Dr. Baker. I do remind you that at the last CARL meeting, we did spend some very specific time in regards to the audit, the process for the audit, the overview, as you said, the methodology. So I just bring that to your attention. This committee has a very broad scope, mm-hmm. and we really do try to keep within our time frame. So we do have to pick and choose and not each time address these. But I do want to make that comment that at our last meeting in particular, we had an overview of audit methodology and outcome. And Dr. Baker, if you want to make a comment about that too.
That was going to be my comment. We do have an audit plan. Danielle Schultz, our internal auditor, is here. She can address those in specific. Yeah. And the audit plan includes criteria for high-risk areas that we look at every year, and then the more random sampling to make sure we're hitting all areas over time. And then as she completes those, that's when they roll into you. And she does have a master sheet that keeps track of that. We could put that on the scorecard, so to speak, to see where, if you want to see where we are in the progress across a year to getting to each of those. That might help you keep score kind of on where we are. That might help organize it.
I surely recall the conversation. I was just surprised that there was maybe a reference to it as to the status of that plan now, or maybe going forward, just each meeting, could we just get the summary sheet, right, to know if we're gaining ground, or is a red, yellow, green sort of thing on the status of the audits.
Well, I very much appreciate your comments. And I particularly appreciate your sensitivity to audits, and given your extremely relevant background, that this is an area of great sensitivity to you, and your input is of great value. So we take your comments with great seriousness. And I'll work with Danielle, and we will try and include that on a more regular basis. But my comments were just for the record, to reemphasize that we did do that at the last meeting. So,
thank you.
But thank you very much for your comments. Our next committee is scheduled for May 19th. Do I have a motion to adjourn this meeting?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. We are adjourned. Thank you.